The first glimpse that Vicky had of her husband after 6 months appalled her. "You are so thin," she cried. "I have not been eating very well." He sat down on the stool facing her through the mesh of the screen. They had developed a cryptic code during the 4 visits she'd been allowed at Pretoria Central, and not eating well meant that he was on another hunger strike. He smiled at her, and his face was skull-like, so that his lips had retracted and his teeth were too big for his face. When he placed his hands on the shelf in front of him, his wrists protruded from the cuffs of his khaki prison uniform, and they were bone covered with a thin layer of skin. "Let me see my son," he said, and she drew Matthew to her. "Greet your father," she told the boy, and he stared solemnly at Moses through the grill. The gaunt stranger on the other side of the wire had never picked him up or held him on his lap, had never kissed or fondled him, had never even touched him. The mesh was always between them. A warder sat beside Moses to see that the visiting rules were strictly observed. The time allowed was 1 hour, 60 minutes exactly. And only family matters could be discussed. No news of the day, no discussion of prison conditions, and especially nothing with a political flavour to it. 1 hour of family matters, but they used their code. "I am sure that my appetite will return once I have news of the family," Moses told her. "On paper." So she knew that he was hunger-striking to be allowed to read the newspapers. Therefore, he would not have heard the news about Nelson Mandela. "The elders have asked Gundwani to visit them," she told him. Gundwani was their code name for Mandela. It meant Cane Rat, and the elders were the authorities. He nodded to show that he understood that Mandela had at last been arrested, and he smiled tautly. The information he had given to Manfred de la Rey had been used effectively. "How are the family members of the farm?" he asked. "All is well and they are planting their crops," Vicky told him, and he understood that the Umkhonto we Sizwe teams, working out of Paxil, had begun their campaign of terror bombings. "Perhaps you will all be reunited sooner than we think," she suggested. "Let us hope so," Moses agreed. A reunion would mean that the Pux Hill team would join him here on the island, or take the shorter road to the gallows. The hour passed too swiftly, and the warder was standing up. "Time up! Say your goodbyes." "I leave my heart with you, my husband," Vicky told him, and watched the warder lead him away. He did not look back at her, and his gait dragged like that of an exhausted old man. "It is only the starvation," she told Joseph, as they walked back to the ferry. "He is still courageous as a lion, but weak from lack of food." "He is finished," Joseph contradicted her quietly. "The Boers have beaten him. He will never breathe the air of freedom again. He will never see the outside of his prison again." "For all of us born black, this whole country is a prison," Vicky said fiercely. And Joseph did not reply until they were once more aboard the ferry and running back before the gale towards the flat-topped mountain whose lower slopes were flecked with white walls and shining glass. "Moses Gama chose the wrong road," Joseph said. "He tried to assault the walls of the White Fortress. He tried to burn it down, not realizing that even if he had succeeded, all he would have inherited would have been ashes." "And you, Joseph Dinizulu?" Vicky flashed at him scornfully. "You are wiser?" "Perhaps not, but at least I will learn from the mistakes of Moses Gama and Nelson Mandela. I will not spend my life rotting in a white man's prison." "How will you assault the white man's prison, my clever little brother?" "I will cross the lower drawbridge," he said. "I will go in through the open gates, and one day the castle and its treasures will be mine, even if I have to share a little of them with the white man. No, my angry little sister, I will not destroy those treasures with bombs and flames. I will inherit them." "You are mad, Joseph Dinizulu." She stared at him, and he smiled complacently at her. "We shall see who is mad and who is sane," he said. "But remember this, little sister, that without the white man, we would still be living in grass huts. Look to the north and see the misery of those countries which have driven out the whites." "Ha!
No, my sister, I will keep the white man here. But one day, he will work for me, not I for him.
Forget your anger, my son. Hendrik Tabaka leaned forward and placed his right hand on Raleigh's shoulder. Your anger will destroy you. Your enemy is too strong. See what has happened to Moses Gama, my own brother. See what is the fate of Nelson Mandela. They went out to fight the lion with bare hands.
Others are still fighting, Raleigh pointed out. The warriors of Amkonte with Sizwe are still fighting. Every day we hear of their brave deeds. Every day their bombs explode. They are throwing pebbles at a mountain, Hendrik said sadly. Every time they explode a little bomb against the pylon of a power line, Forster and Delarey arm another 1,000 police and write another 100 banning orders.
Hendrik shook his head.
Forget your anger, my son. There is a fine line for you at my side. If you follow Moses Gama and Mandela, you will end the way they have ended. But I can offer you wealth and power. Take a wife, Raleigh, a good, fat wife, and give her many sons. Forget the madness, and take your place at my side.
I had a wife, my father, and I left her at Sharpeville, Raleigh said. But before I left her, I made a vow. With my fingers deep in her bloody wounds, I made a vow.
Vows are easy to make, Hendrik said,
and Raleigh saw how age had played like a blowtorch across his features, withering and searing and melting the bold lines of his cheekbones and jaw.
But vows are difficult to live with. Your brother Wellington has also made a vow to the white man's god. He will live like a eunuch for the rest of his life, without ever knowing the comfort of a woman's body.
I fear for you, Raleigh, fruit of my loins. I fear that your own vow will be a heavy burden for all of your life.
He sighed again.
But since I cannot persuade you, what can I do to ease the rocky pathway for you?
You know that many of the young people are leaving this country, Raleigh asked.
Not only the young ones,
Hendrik nodded.
Some of the high command have gone also. Oliver Tambo has fled, and Imbeki, and Joe Modise, with many others.
They have gone to set the first phase of the revolution afoot. Raleigh's eyes began to shine with excitement.
Lenin himself taught us that we cannot move immediately to the communist revolution. We must achieve the phase of national liberation first. We have to create a broad front of liberals and churchmen and students and workers under the leadership of the Vanguard Party. Oliver Tambo has gone to create that Vanguard Party, the anti-apartheid movement in exile, and I want to be part of that spearhead of the revolution.
You wish to leave the country of your birth? Hendrik stared at him in bewilderment. You wish to leave me and your family?
It is my duty, father. If the evils of this system are ever to be destroyed, we will need the help of that world out there, of all the United Nations of the world.
You are dreaming, my son, Hendrik told him.
Already that world in which you place so much trust and hope has forgotten Sharpeville. Once again, money from the foreign nations, from America and Britain and France, is pouring into this country. Every day the country prospers.
America has refused to supply arms?
Yes, Hendrik chuckled ruefully.
And the Boers are making their own.
You cannot win, my son. So stay with me. I must go, my father. Forgive me, but I have no choice. I must go, but I need your help.
What do you want me to do? There is a man, a white man, who is helping the young ones to escape.
Hendrik nodded. Joe Cicero.
I want to meet him, father.
It will take a little time, for he is a secret man, this Joe Cicero.
It took almost 2 weeks. They met on a municipal bus that Raleigh boarded at the central depot in Vereeniging. He wore a blue beret, as he had been instructed, and sat in the second row of seats from the back. The man who took the seat directly behind him lit a cigarette, and as the bus pulled away, said softly,
Raleigh Tabaka.
Raleigh turned to look into a pair of eyes like puddles of spilled engine oil. Do not look at me, Joe Cicero said, but listen carefully to what I tell you. 3 weeks later, Raleigh Tabaka, carrying a duffel bag and authentic seaman's papers, went up the gangplank of a Dutch freighter that was carrying a cargo of wool to the port of Liverpool. He never saw the continent disappear below the watery horizon, for he was already below decks, at work in the ship's engine room. Sean did the deal at breakfast on the last day of the safari. The client owned 17 large leather tanneries in as many different states and half the real estate in Tucson, Arizona. His name was Ed Liner, and he was 72 years of age. Son, I don't know why I want to buy myself a safari company. I'm getting a little long in the tooth for this big game stuff, he grumbled. Oh, that's bullshit, Ed, Sean told him. You nearly walked me off my feet after that big jumbo, and the trackers all call you Buona One Shot. Ed Liner looked pleased with himself. He was a wiry little man with a ruff of snowy hair around his brown, freckled pate. Give me the facts again, he invited. One last time. Sean had been working on him for 3 weeks, since the first day of the safari, and he knew Ed had the figures by heart. But he repeated them now. The concession is 500 square miles, with a 40-mile frontage on the south bank of Lake Kariba. As he listened, Ed Liner stroked his wife, as though he were caressing a pet kitten. She was his third wife, and she was just 2 years younger than Sean, but 50 years younger than her husband. She had been a dancer at the Golden Egg in Vegas, and she had dancer's legs and carriage, with big innocent blue eyes and a curling cloud of blonde hair. She watched Sean with a vicious little curl in her cupid bow lips as he made his pitch. Sean had been working on her just as assiduously as he had on her husband, thus far with as little success. All you've got, honey, she had told Sean, is a pretty face and a hungry dick. The woods are full of those. Daddy Eddie has got 50 million bucks. It's no contest, sonny boy. The camp table was set under a magnificent wild fig tree on the banks of the Mara River. It was a bright African morning. The plain beyond the river was golden with winter grass and studded with flat-topped acacia trees. The herds of wildebeest were dark shadows on the gold, and a giraffe was feeding from the upper branches of the nearest acacia, his long, graceful neck swaying against the brittle blue of the sky, his hide paved with bold rectangles of red-brown. From upriver there came the bellowing, sardonic laughter of a bull hippo, while from the branches of the fig tree above them, the golden weaver birds dangled upside down from their woven basket nests, fluttering and shrilling to entice the drab brown females to move in and take up residence. Legend had it that both Hemingway and Ruark had camped at this very spot and breakfasted beneath this same wild fig. What do you think, sugar sticks? Ed Liner ran his bony brown fingers down the inside of his wife's thigh. She wore wide-legged khaki culottes, and from where Sean sat he could see a little red-blonde pubic curl peeping out from under the elastic of her panties. You think we should give old Sean here $500,000 to set up our own safari outfit down in the Zambezi Valley of Rhodesia? You know best, Daddy Eddie, she affected a cute little girl voice. She batted her long eyelashes at him and turned so that her bosom strained the buttons of her khaki shirt. Just think of it, Sean invited. Your very own hunting concession, to do with as you want. He watched her carefully as he went on. You could shoot the full quota all yourself if you wanted, as many animals as you wanted. Despite her curls and pouting lips, Lana Liner had as vicious a sadistic streak as any man Sean had ever hunted with. While Ed had chosen only to take the lion and elephant that he had paid for, Lana had killed every single animal she was entitled to, and then had killed those her husband had refused. She was a passable shot, and derived as much pleasure from cutting down one of the dainty little Thompson's gazelles with her .300 Weatherby Magnum as she had when she dropped her black-maned Maasai lion with a perfect heart shot.
He had seen the sexual radiance in her immediately after each kill, heard her rapid breathing, and seen the pulse beat in her throat with excitement. And his philanderer's instinct had assured him that Lana Liner was vulnerable to him only in those few minutes after she had seen the bullet strike and the blood flash. "As much hunting as you want, whenever you want it," Sean tempted her, and saw the excitement in her baby blue eyes. She ran the tip of her tongue over her scarlet lips and said in her breathless little girl voice,
"Why don't you buy it for my birthday, Daddy Eddie?"
"Oh, goddamn," Ed laughed. "Why not? Okay, son, you've got yourself a deal. We'll call it, Lana Safaris. I'll get my lawyers to draw up the papers as soon as we get home to Tucson."
Sean clapped his hands and shouted at the kitchen tent,
"Maramba, ileta champagne, hapa, pacey pacey."
And the camp waiter, in his long white kanza and red pillbox fez, brought the green bottle on its silver tray, dewed with cold from the refrigerator. They drank the wine and laughed in the morning sunlight, and shook hands and discussed the new venture until the gun-bearer brought the hunting car around with the rifles in the racks, and Matatu, the Indorobo tracker, perched up on the back and grinning like a monkey.
"I had enough," Ed said. "Guess I'll get packed up and ready to meet the charter plane when it comes in this afternoon."
Then he saw the pout of disappointment on Lana's red lips.
"You go off with Sean, Sugar Sticks," he told her. "Have a good hunt, but don't be late back. The charter flight is due to arrive at 3, and we must get back to Nairobi before dark."